John Delaney was the first in 2017. Jeanette Rankin was also the first in 1916. And James Polk was the 11th in 1844. It's all about numbers on The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. John Delaney was the first Democrat to run for president in 2020. In fact, he started running nearly 2 years ago.
What I bring is a pretty unique background as a kid raised in a blue-collar family who became a very successful entrepreneur. And then I rolled up my sleeves and I went to the House of Representatives and I tried to get things done.
Plus, will Donald Trump's use of Twitter forever change the way presidents communicate?
Not only does the president get to say what the story is, that president also has a significant ability to shape the conversation because the story is framed in the way that the tweet is framed. That is a huge advantage.
And we remember Jeanette Rankin, the first woman ever to serve in Congress, who was sworn in 102 years ago this week.
Rankin comes from a suffrage background. She was a progressive who believed in social reform. Rankin was actually part of a number of members who voted against U.S. entry into World War I.
It's all coming up on The Political Junkie, which starts right now.
You like Ike, I like Ike, everybody likes Ike.
For president.
Add Ike to you, add Ike to me, I don't care how you quote it.
Come on and vote for Kennedy, vote for Kennedy, and we'll come out on top.
Vote for Richard Nixon and Henry Cabot Lodge, cause they're the ones to lead the USA.
Thanks for joining us, and welcome to episode 271 of The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. I'm away this week, which gives us an opportunity to rerun some of the more memorable segments from previous years, about everything from the first candidate who declared his candidacy for 2020 to the first woman ever elected to Congress. For the record, James Polk was the first president to have an icebox in the White House, but he's known for more than that. Meanwhile, you still have one more week to solve our latest trivia question, which is, before Mark Udall of Colorado and Tom Udall of New Mexico, who were the last relatives who served in the Senate at the same time? Send your answer to trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll select a winner at random from the bunch. The winner will get a fabulous vintage Political Junkie button. Again, that's trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com.
Hey, brother, there's an endless road to rediscover. Hey, sister, do you still believe in love, I wonder? Oh, if the sky comes falling down for you, there's nothing in.
With so many candidates running for president, it's understandable that people are starting to lose count. But back in the summer of 2017, the list was, well, none. That is, until John Delaney, then a Democratic congressman from Maryland, announced his candidacy. Who knew he'd be such a trendsetter? I spoke with Congressman Delaney back in August of 2017, about 2 weeks after he first declared his candidacy, back when he had the field all to himself. Congressman, welcome to The Political Junkie.
It's great to be on, Ken.
Well, let me start with the why. Why are you running?
Well, for two reasons. First, I think politics is broken in this country, and hyper-partisanship is really preventing us from doing anything. And that's coming with a very, very high cost to the American people. And I believe I have a better way of leading and governing that can change that. And secondly, I think we're really not talking about the most important issues in the country. The most important thing for us to talk about is the future and how the very profound changes that are going on in the world right now, you know, based on technology and automation and global interconnections, are reshaping the world. They're reshaping our economy. They're reshaping jobs and even reshaping security threats. And we're just not, as a nation, focused on the things we need to do to prepare our country for that future. And I think it's fairly obvious what we should be doing, but the political debate seems to me to be entirely about the past. So I think I have not only a broader, more forward-leaning vision for the future of the country that I want to execute against, but I also believe I have an approach to governing that will, you know, bring us together as a country and get us in a position where we could start doing the things we need to do.
You earlier mentioned the excessive partisanship that surrounds us, and you also mentioned that in your Washington Post op-ed. But you know that it's not going to diminish as we get closer to 2020.
No, but as you may know, Ken, I was an entrepreneur prior to running for office. I started two businesses from scratch that became publicly traded on the New York Stock Exchange, and I ran them. And so I've always believed that what's important is to focus on where things are going, not where they are. And it's my opinion that the American people are getting fed up with what's gone on in Washington, but more importantly, they're getting fed up with the way the political parties behave and what partisanship is doing to our country. And I think they're looking for a change. And I think they're looking for someone who wants to talk about bringing us together, you know, returning civility, if you will, to the public discourse, who has a respect for public service and the things that we can do as a nation. And even though it's very partisan and it's likely to continue to be partisan as we come up to the elections, I think when the American people are making this incredibly important decision in 2020, I think they're going to look to move beyond that to some extent and return to a time where there could be a more civil discourse and we can get things done. And that's the bet I'm willing to make. And I'm willing to make that bet in part because I have so much confidence in the American people. And I don't think the American people are going to continue to let, you know, people who put party ahead of country get in their way to the progress that they deserve.
Well, that leads to this question. I mean, I hear what you're saying, but do you feel, or should I say, do you fear that Democratic voters are going to want their standard bearer to be a partisan, someone who's willing to throw back at Trump what he's thrown at them? I mean, they're angry. The Democratic base right now seems very angry.
Yeah, I mean, the Democratic base is angry, and as a Democrat, I'm very angry, right? If you look at what's happened to our party across the last, you know, many years, we've lost over 1,000 seats at the state legislature level. We've lost the House of Representatives. We've lost the Senate. And now we've lost the White House. And so we've basically put ourselves in a position where the things we're fighting for and the things we care about, it's very hard for us to make them happen. And we're forced to basically play defense. And I think Democratic voters are going to feel like I do about this, which is obviously we have to resist the things that President Trump is doing that offends our values and threatens what we really stand for as a nation. But we also have to put forth our own vision and our own plan as to how we can make a difference in people's lives. So I just think the American people and the Democratic Party included in that really do want to return to a time where we can actually make progress for people as opposed to just simply engaging in partisan battles. Because if we've learned anything, we've learned that the way our country was designed by our founding fathers, which was, you know, ingenious if you think about how it's protecting us today with some of the things the president wants to do, our country was designed so that real progress can only occur if we work together. That's the only way you make enduring progress where things have an opportunity to live a healthy life. And I think the American people, or a majority of them at least, are going to want to return to that. And that's what my campaign is going to be about.
I want to play a part of a Delaney campaign commercial from your first run in 2012.
We've got a mess in Congress between the special interests and the extremists on the right. The needs of the middle class are ignored. This is the fight I want to take up for progressive values, good jobs, a budget that closes loopholes, protects social programs, and creates a government on the side of people. I'm John Delaney. This is something we can do together.
Congressman, 5 years later, what have you learned and what do you think you've accomplished in your years in Congress?
So first of all, I think that's a great ad and I could use it again today because my message hasn't changed. What I've accomplished on a few, I think, very important topics is to do what I just said, which is change the conversation, right? And actually focus on the way we can come together and get some things done. You know, I spent a lot of time since I've been in Congress working on a transformative proposal to increase infrastructure investment in this country. And it's been met with very significant bipartisan support. At different times, we've had over 40 Democrats and 40 Republicans supporting a proposal to spend $1 trillion on infrastructure and rebuild all our communities, our roads, our bridges, our energy, communications infrastructure. And it's fully paid for by fixing the international tax system, which currently encourages U.S. corporations to keep trillions of dollars of cash overseas. And so what I did is I came up with an entirely new proposal and new solutions to build infrastructure and fix the part of our tax code that is the most kind of non-competitive. And it was, I think, refreshing in the eyes of so many of the members, which is why it's received such bipartisan support, because there's really no examples of bipartisan support in the Congress on tax and spending legislation. Yet I've come up with a new proposal that has significant bipartisan support. So those are the kind of solutions that I'm talking about. And I think as the president, I can drive those kind of solutions home and deliver for the American people.
Now, you're thought to be one of the richest members of Congress. Do you intend to spend some of your fortune on your campaign?
I, just like I have in my congressional races, I intend to invest in my campaign to make sure we have the kind of campaign that can deliver the message and contact voters as needed. So the way we've always approached this is we develop our plan and we develop our budget. You know, we've been blessed to have a lot of terrific support from people in our campaigns. But to the extent we need more resources, I'm happy to invest in my campaign because I believe in what I'm doing.
Speaking of money, I know you're close to with Bill and Hillary Clinton. I know you donated money to her campaign, and the former president made a key endorsement of you back in 2012. Have you had a chance to talk to them about your candidacy?
You know, I haven't really spoken to them specifically. We've kind of gone back and forth, but haven't had the long conversation.
Well, let me ask you this question. This is a very important question. How many times have you heard the name James Garfield in the past 2 weeks?
A lot more starting 10 days ago.
Of course, just in case our listeners don't know that James Garfield, the last sitting member of the House to be elected, and that was only back in 1880.
Yes.
You know, a lot have tried, you know, the Mo Udalls, the Ron Pauls, the Pat Schroeders, the Jack Kemps of the world. Obviously, you're up against history, but you're also up against, well, tell me what you're up against.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, people have made that point to me. But again, I kind of think about it differently. And the way I think about it is as follows, which is, I think the American people are looking for someone who has new ideas, and they want that person to have public service experience. In other words, they want those people, that person to be the kind of person that's actually rolled up their sleeves and entered the field of public service. I think what I bring to the country is a pretty unique background as a kid raised in a blue-collar family whose parents didn't go to college, who became a very successful entrepreneur from scratch and started and led to well-admired companies. And then I rolled up my sleeves and I went to the House of Representatives and I behaved the way I said I would and tried to get things done. I think that's a unique perspective. And I don't think they're going to, again, I think that kind of political class kind of looks at the House of Representatives versus the Senate. But you and I both know a lot of people who run statewide in certain states in this country really don't represent many more people than a member of the House does. And the truth of the matter is I think the real reason why more people aren't elected president from the House of Representatives is because very few of them run. And the reason very few of them run is because they have to give up their seat to do it typically. And, you know, you don't find examples of senators and governors who typically run for president when they're up for reelection because they don't want to take the risk of giving up their job. But as someone who doesn't view myself as a politician, as a career, I view myself as an entrepreneur in terms of my career, and now I'm doing public service. I'm willing to take the risk of giving up my job to take this next step because I think I can make a difference.
And you're not waiting for 2020 to give up your seat. You're giving up your seat in 2018.
Yeah, and the reason for that is I think, you know, to be honest with you, the 1 year, the one very intense year when you're running for president, which is typically... Well, it's really both years, right? So it's certainly the year before the primaries occur, and then certainly part of that next year. This is really a full-time job. And I think some people try to do it from the Congress, but they find themselves in a situation where they either have to decide between campaigning or representing their constituents. And I didn't want to make that choice. I wanted to tell people that this is what I'm going to do, that I have conviction behind what I'm doing, that I'm committed, that I'm all in, and that I'm not willing to compromise my constituents to advance my political career.
Congressman Delaney, it's an honor having you in the program.
Well, it's great to be with you, and I'm happy to come back anytime you'll have me.
John Delaney was a 3-term Democratic member of the House from Maryland, the first announced candidate for his party's 2020 presidential nomination. Pop quiz. How did Rex Tillerson find out that President Trump fired him as Secretary of State? It was on Twitter. How did we learn that Mike Pompeo met with Kim Jong-un? The news of the missile attack in Syria? That Trump called Kim Little Rocket Man? Twitter. In fact, Donald Trump's use of Twitter may not have only changed social media forever, but it's changed the way the president, this president, communicates with the country. Who needs press conferences when there's Twitter? Every president had his own way of communicating with the people, trying to bring them to his point of view through persuasion. Franklin Roosevelt had his fireside chats. John Kennedy was adept at televised news conferences. Bill Clinton understood cable news. The use of communication tactics of the past quarter century, from Clinton, then George W. Bush, then Barack Obama, and now Trump, is the subject of a deeply researched book, Presidential Communication and Character, by Stephen Farnsworth. He's a political science professor and the director of the Center for Leadership and Media Studies at the University of Mary Washington. Steve, it's great having you back on The Political Junkie.
Glad to be here.
Well, with all these new types of communications, with social media taking on the role it has today, one might think it would be more difficult than ever for a president to get his message out.
Yeah, I think that one of the things that's really clear about the way the Trump presidency has been covered by the media is that reporters as well as politicians have just simply abandoned these traditional ideas of news conferences and press releases as the main way to get the word out and simply just use Twitter. I mean, in many ways, the Trump presidency has been basically reporters following what Trump has tweeted on Twitter. It is the assignment editor for Washington reporters in the age of Donald Trump. What he tweets today is what the reporters are chasing this afternoon.
Exactly. All the reporters, there's always been so much media criticism of Trump that he doesn't hold press conferences. But if you look at his nonstop tweets, I mean, we basically know what he's thinking at all times.
Yeah, and it is important to recognize that that is still a very powerful dominating fact in American media. I mean, one of the big problems that we've seen, whatever the media outlet, whatever the era, has been the ability of Congress to compete with the White House. In modern media, it's become even worse because ultimately when the president has something to say, whether it's via Twitter or a news conference or a campaign rally, reporters are going to cover that. And not only does the president get to say what the story is, that president also has a significant ability to shape the conversation because the story is framed in the way that the tweet is framed. If you have that kind of ability to shape the discourse, that is a huge advantage. I mean, if we're talking about Roseanne instead of the Russia investigation, if we're talking about the intramural fights within the Trump administration over who's leaking and who's not or who should be Attorney General or Secretary of State, we're not having a conversation about trade policy or the budget deficit or what should be happening in North Korea or Afghanistan. It's an extraordinary power. We're not necessarily as citizens better informed as a result, but for a president, it's a great opportunity. And Donald Trump has used Twitter more effectively than any president has been able to do.
And the thing that's so interesting about the tweets is that many of his tweets may be untrue and certainly mean-spirited, but they are effective. It rallies his supporters. And it lets us, again, as I said, it lets us know what he's thinking.
Yeah, well, there are a couple of key things to appreciate about the way that Donald Trump tweets. I mean, in many ways, Twitter is perfect for Donald Trump because he doesn't have a real depth of understanding of issues. He doesn't really want to sell issues in a point-by-point way. He'd much rather talk about issues in terms of the length of a bumper sticker or the length of a tweet. Just simply say that some of them are good people, but most of them, Trump has said, are not so good people. And so you focus on those kinds of momentary eruptions, if you will, the tweets, and not really get through the complications of, let's say, with trade policy. You know, if you decide to increase tariffs on products, people will increase tariffs on you. So there is this whole complication of policymaking that simply disappears on Twitter. And you also don't have to necessarily be as committed to the truth on Twitter because, of course, the speed with which Donald Trump tweets really outpaces the ability of reporters to get into the game and say, well, actually, that's not true, that's not true, that's not true. It's the old saying from Mark Twain that a lie goes all the way around the world before the truth gets its boots on. And if anything, Twitter has accelerated that process. And when the reporters are trying to say, well, this isn't true and that isn't true, Trump has already moved on to another issue.
You know, you talk about all the issues that he does talk about on trade policy and foreign relations and all that, but has any tweet gotten as much dissection and analysis as the one that said Covfefe?
Well, you know, I figured we'd be having this conversation about that particular tweet because it didn't make a lot of sense. But it just speaks, I think, to the extent to which so much of news has become entertainment. So much of the presidency has become, in effect, a reality show. You're looking at that kind of tweet, which really was nonsensical, and people trying to parse some deeper meaning into what was perhaps the world's most famous typo.
Although going back to the topic of character, you think of Bill Clinton, who was under assault even before he was elected over women and avoiding the draft. I mean, how do you survive something like that, let alone prosper?
Well, I think what we've seen in many ways with the modern media environment is a great deal of indulgence of personal foibles. I mean, we know more about people, whether they're presidents or celebrities or whoever they might be, than ever before. And there is a sense that those sorts of things don't matter as much. I mean, you might look at Bill Clinton and say that he lowered the bar in terms of acceptable moral behavior in public life. And I think that's a fair point to make. But I would say that you would say the same thing about Donald Trump. Whatever, you know, we saw with Bill Clinton and Bill Clinton's misconduct, we're seeing the, you know, comparable developments with respect to Donald Trump. I mean, Bill Clinton behaved in ways that would have been fatal to a previous president or presidential candidate, if you think about their political viability. Not just 4 years before Bill Clinton becomes president, Gary Hart, a candidate for president in 1988. His story is completely unwound because of an extramarital affair that is discovered by reporters. Somehow Bill Clinton survives all the scandals of 1992, and then he behaves in ways that are astonishingly reckless, and then we have the Clinton-Lewinsky scandal and the impeachment of 1998. But in many ways, you're looking at an environment where there is this opportunity to come back, because the enemies of one side in our highly partisan times are seen as so much more unpleasant than the idea that you have to turn on your own president. So the advantage that Bill Clinton had was that Kenneth Starr and the Republicans in Congress seemed like latter-day Puritans. And in many ways, the advantage that Donald Trump has is that there was a great deal of hostility to Hillary Clinton in the country, and that meant that it didn't really matter about the porn stars or the Access Hollywood tape or any of the rest. And so the character, I think, really see that as we talk about politicians today, isn't just a matter of being an upright moral person. In some ways, that's beside the point for many voters. What it is does this person channel my beliefs, my anxieties, my anger, my fear, my optimism, whatever it might be. And that's the success of a presidential candidate. I think Barack Obama in 2008, when you talk about hope and change, spoke to a more elevated view of America's future. And that worked at that time. And what worked for Donald Trump is a much more dystopian vision of the future. And that kind of anger rather than hopefulness is really the effective strategy 8 years later.
You know, your book focuses on Clinton, Bush, and Obama, and I don't think it's a coincidence that all three of them won re-election to a second term, and I think that's only happened once before in history. It was Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, and James Monroe. That's how long it's been since three in a row were re-elected to a second term. But I guess my question is, did Clinton, Bush, and Obama understand communication strategies that, say, Jimmy Carter or Bush Sr. failed to grasp?
Well, I do think that there's a certain element of that. I think that remember, there is a generational dynamic here. I mean, Bill Clinton is the first television generation, those people who grew up with television as a part of their youth, as their adolescence and of their early adulthood. And so they have a much more natural affinity for that kind of connection with the public that simply didn't exist when George H.W. Bush was a child or when Bob Dole was a boy. But if you think about Bill Clinton, he was very good at the talk show. He could really connect with people, speak speak to them on a personal level. And so the sort of cable news talk show, the Donahue era of the Bill Clinton presidency, he was very good at that. I think that that George W. Bush was good at the use of Fox News, particularly to talk about things and to minimize the problems that were obvious to people not looking at Fox News with respect to Iraq or Katrina or elsewhere. And then Barack Obama, I think he was very good at Facebook. When you think about the social media ability to use YouTube and Facebook and video chats, he had a very good instinctive relationship with that. And of course, Donald Trump, born to tweet. You're looking at presidents who were very, very effective at the media environment of the moment. What's really different, I think, about these four presidents is that the media environment has changed so rapidly that presidents really have to develop new media strategies basically every presidency. It was so similar when you're thinking about the way that presidents dealt with the media, say, between Reagan and Jack Kennedy for those decades, or between, say, Coolidge and Eisenhower, where radio was dominant, or the print era before that. I mean, over and over again, we've seen really small changes in American history in terms of the media environment. But now, in the last couple of decades, the changes have been so much more radical, so much more rapid, so much more powerful. And that's created very different strategies for presidents. And so I think that it speaks to the possibility that Donald Trump may be a kind of a one-off president, that his ability to use Twitter may not be the model for the next president to use because the media environment has changed so rapidly over these most recent presidents.
Stephen Farnsworth is a political science professor and the director of the Center for Leadership and Media Studies at the University of Mary Washington. He is the author of the new book, Presidential Communication and Character. Steve, it's great having you on the program.
Thanks so much, Ken.
I just gotta get a message to you.
It's time for This Week in Political History. There are currently 102 women serving in the United States House of Representatives. 25 are in the Senate. Both are all-time records. 100 years ago, there was just one woman serving in Congress. That was Jeanette Rankin, a Republican from Montana, first elected in 1916. More than 300 women have served in the House since, but Rankin was first. Being the first woman elected to Congress is not the only bit of history made by Jeanette Rankin. She was the only member of Congress, man or woman, to have voted against U.S. entry into both World War I and World War II. Matt Wesniewski is the House historian who knows a thing or two about women in Congress. In fact, 10 years ago, he put together a voluminous book entitled, ready for it, Women in Congress. Matt, it's great having you on The Political Junkie.
Great to be here, Ken. Thanks for having me.
This week, we're celebrating the anniversary of the swearing-in of the first female member of the House. Now, it's April. Congress back then was sworn in March. Why was Jeanette Rankin sworn in April?
Well, the official start date of Congress was in early March prior to the 20th Amendment. But typically, Congress wouldn't come into session until December of that year after the election.
So like 13 months after the election.
13 months, uh-huh. Yeah. And in Rankin's case, it was a special session that had been called by President Woodrow Wilson. He wanted to come before Congress and ask for a declaration of war against Imperial Germany, because Germany had pursued unrestricted submarine warfare and finally pushed the U.S. into the conflict.
He's the guy who kept us out of war in 1916. So when Jeanette Rankin was sworn in on April 2nd, 1917, that was the day that Wilson went before Congress asking for a declaration of war.
Yes, to make the world safe for democracy.
What's interesting to me, I mean, there's so many things interesting to me about Jeanette Rankin, but she was elected in 1916. Now, I know in Montana, women had the right to vote in Montana, but nationally, they did not. This is before the 19th Amendment.
Yeah, this is 4 years before the 19th Amendment was ratified in 1920. But Rankin comes from a suffrage background. She came of age in the progressive era. She was a progressive who believed in social reform and suffrage, women's voting rights. And she had been instrumental in helping Montana women gain the right to vote in 1914. Western states starting with Wyoming and Colorado, had granted women the right to vote.
Huh. So she was sworn in on April 2nd. President Wilson went before Congress on April 2nd. When was the vote to authorize war against Imperial Germany?
In the wee hours of April 6th, early in the morning, the House had debated it for a few days. And Rankin was actually part of a number of members, about 50, who voted against U.S. entry into World War I. And that position that she had was popular back home with her constituents in Montana. She actually, when the roll call came, violated House rules by giving a brief little speech when she cast her vote. Instead of saying yay or nay, she got up and said, I'd like to support my country, but I cannot vote for war. No. But again, she was part of a small group of members, including Claude Kitchen, who was the Democratic, the majority leader at that point. So she wasn't alone in that vote.
As you say, she was among 50, 55 or so members of the House who voted against World War I. Did that affect her? I mean, did she run for re-election in 1918? What happened with her a second term?
Yeah, she didn't run into political problems because of that vote. Essentially, because of redistricting in Montana, she had been elected to one of two at-large seats and had come in as the second top vote-getter in that 1916 election. What happens in during her term in the House is that Montana makes those seats two distinct districts, and her district became part of a western district in Montana. And she had a very unpalatable choice of kind of running outside of her stronghold. And so she didn't run for that seat. And instead, she runs for a U.S. Senate seat, doesn't win the Republican nomination for that, and runs as a third-party candidate.
For the Senate.
For the Senate. And gets about a fifth of the votes without any party support. But she loses to the Democratic incumbent in that case and leaves the House.
As somebody who fought for the right for women to vote, if she were still alive today, she'd be furious what's going on in Washington and Oregon because they have all male voting, don't they? That's a joke I've been using. It's an all male. It's a M-A-I-L.
Gotcha.
Yeah, okay.
Gotcha.
Thought I'd try that joke one more time. Okay, so she runs for Congress in 1940, and then this happens about a year after her election.
Yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy.
President Roosevelt goes to the Congress, asks for a declaration of war. This is the same thing that happened to her when she was first elected in 1916, a different president, same enemy, basically, and she has to make a decision.
Yeah, and in that interwar period, she had been very active in the pacifist movement, and she had run for the Montana seat in 1940 on a pacifist platform, very clear about that. She comes to the House, and we have the attack on Pearl Harbor. And December 8th, 1941, FDR addresses the House. The House very quickly moves to a vote. The Senate very quickly returned a unanimous vote for war, and House leaders wanted to follow suit. And they knew Rankin was going to be a problem. We've actually done some oral histories with people who were on the floor at that point, including the reading clerk of the House and some pages. They have memories of various Republican members coming up to Rankin on the floor, Everett Dirksen being one of them, putting their arms around her and saying, vote your conscience, but don't vote against the war. Vote present if you can't support it. And she chose to vote her conscience. She was the only member of Congress to vote against that declaration of war.
She was one of 55 or so who voted against World War I, but the only one to vote against World War II. Now, there were a lot of Republicans back then who were elected in 1940 who were isolationists, but they voted for the war. She did not.
No, she didn't. It was her pacifist beliefs that pushed her. It wasn't that she was necessarily an isolationist, like a lot of the opposition to FDR. She believed that war was immoral and stood her ground.
As you said, 1917, her vote against the war was not terribly unpopular at home, but being the sole dissenter to vote against war after the attack on Pearl Harbor, that was not a popular position.
Not at all. It effectively ended her career. And she knew it. When she cast the vote, there were audible gasps, hisses, and boos on the floor. She had to be escorted out of a phone booth that she'd taken refuge in because she was being besieged by the press. Her brother, Wellington, who was active in politics in Montana and had been her longtime supporter and underwrote her campaigns, called her and said, Montana's 100% against you. And that just effectively ended her career. She didn't stand for re-election in 1942.
As long as I have you, you are the House historian. And of course, this week of political history is about Jeanette Rankin. But you know about so many other women in who served in Congress who have made history. I just want to throw out some names, and it's like a lightning round. But just give me the first thing that comes into your mind. Margaret Chase Smith.
Margaret Chase Smith, first woman to serve in both the House and the Senate. She'd been on the Naval Affairs Committee in the House. She moved to Armed Services. She helped pass the Armed Services Integration Act, which got women into the military after World War II. She moves on to that other body, the Declaration of Conscience speech.
Joe McCarthy.
Against Joe McCarthy. Very principled, very strong woman.
Well, let me ask you about Shirley Chisholm, another name that pops out. She's also made history as being the first.
Shirley Chisholm is the first African-American woman to serve in Congress, elected from a Brooklyn district in 1968. She came into the House and shook it up. I mean, that's the era of Bella Abzug was one of her New York colleagues. Yeah. And she was cut from the same mold. That was really a completely different generation from Margaret Chase Smith or Jeanette Rankin. I mean, this was the feminist wave of the 60s. And
unbossed and unbought.
That's exactly right. And she spoke her mind. She, very early on, House leaders tried to put her on the Agriculture Committee.
a tree grows in Brooklyn, right?
A tree does grow in Brooklyn, but she got up and said, I just don't have many farmers in my district. She went right to the press, and she eventually gets onto the House Rules Committee, which is, as you know, a very powerful committee. And
another New York Democrat, Geraldine Ferraro.
And Ferraro is, of course, the first woman to be put on the nomination ticket as vice president.
And Nancy Pelosi is the first?
She's the first Speaker of the House. First woman Speaker of the House, yes.
Here's a name that nobody talks about, but she does hold a record in history, Edith Norris Rogers.
Yes, Edith Norris Rogers is someone who comes in that era when, just a few years after Rankin, she comes into the House in 1925, and her husband, John Rogers, had been a senior member of the Foreign Affairs Committee and had fallen sick. And she had a long period of service kind of helping him out in his office. She knew his legislative agenda. He passes away in late 1924. She runs in the special election. She's approached by party leaders. It's from a district in northern Massachusetts.
And she's a Republican.
She's a Republican. And they expect that she's just going to serve in the House for a brief term, and then they're going to find a suitable male candidate to replace her. But she has completely different ideas. She gets in, and she wants to stay in. And she stays in for a long time. She stays in until, actually, she dies in 1960 running for re-election, so almost 35 years. And for many years, she was the longest-serving woman in Congress. She's still the longest-serving in the House. But Barbara Mikulski of Maryland, who has a joint House and Senate service, surpassed her as longest-serving Congresswoman.
Somehow I could see them turning off the microphones in the studio here, and you and I sitting here for hours talking about great moments in congressional history.
Absolutely.
Matt Wesniewski is the historian of the U.S. House of Representatives. You can find great stuff from him and his group on Twitter at U.S. House History. Matt, thanks so much.
Thanks so much, Ken.
It was 102 years ago this week, on April 2nd, 1917, that Jeanette Rankin, a Republican from Montana, was sworn in as the first woman in congressional history. That date has another significance as well. President Woodrow Wilson came to Congress and asked for a declaration of war against Germany, which would become World War I. Rankin would vote against it. She would serve only one term, but then come back and win again in 1940. And in 1941, she became the only member of Congress to vote against entering World War II as well. You're listening to This Week in Political History on The Political Junkie.
What is it good for? to me.
Let's be honest. It's a pain every time you're about to move. It's worse when you're forced to move several times. And I'm sure it's even worse if you have to move a bunch of times and you've been dead 170 years. That's what happened to James K. Polk, the 11th president of the United States. He's been dead since 1849, but he's been interred in three different places since. So what does this all mean to Robert Mary? Mary's a longtime journalist who spent years at the Wall Street Journal and Congressional Quarterly. He's the editor of the American Conservative magazine. We had him on the Political Junkie several years ago to talk about his book, where he rates presidential candidates. But he's also the author of A Country of Vast Designs, James K. Polk, The Mexican War, and the Conquest of the American Continent. So if anyone had an opinion about James K. Polk, I figured it would be Robert W. Mary. He joins us now, and we'll see if I'm right. Bob, welcome back to the Political Junkie.
Ken, it's always a pleasure to be with you.
Thanks, Bob. It's been written that James Polk was the most successful one-term president in our history. Now, I would suspect that much of our audience out there knows very little, if nothing, about number 11. Tell me about James Polk.
Well, Polk was a highly consequential president. He entered the office with four goals, all very, very ambitious. He wanted to get California from Mexico, which was quite audacious, and he probably knew that that was going to entail a war or a great threat of war. He wanted to get Oregon Territory from the Brits. It was actually jointly occupied. That entailed some diplomacy that came very close to war. He wanted to create a independent treasury, it was called, which is a forerunner to the Fed, and he wanted to cut tariff rates. And he did all those things in 4 years, and then he, as he had promised to do when he got the nomination, he drifted off back to Tennessee and promptly died. I think he, frankly, worked himself to death. He was a workaholic, not a particularly sympathetic figure, but extremely dedicated to work and to his goals, as we can see from his presidency.
But even before you get to his presidency, when the Democrats met in 1844, ballot one, ballot two, ballot through ballot seven, there was no mention of Polk at all. I mean, he was a true dark horse.
He was the first, he was the original American dark horse. And that was kind of his life. He was always in the shadow of his great mentor, Andrew Jackson, who loved him and whom he loved. He didn't have the outsized personality of a Jackson. He had a small-sized personality. He was a rather drab of temperament. But by golly, he was relentless and clever and wily. He politically positioned himself to be the dark horse. Failing that, he was hoping, although things weren't really going very well, that perhaps he might get the vice presidential nod. You see, the problem with Polk is that he spent 14 years in Congress. He was chairman of Ways and Means. He was very prominent in Congress.
He was the Speaker of the House, right?
He was Speaker of the House. And then he goes and he runs for governor of Tennessee, two-year term. Didn't really want to do it. He liked Washington. He was doing well. Nice constitutional position he had. But they wanted him to because the Democratic Party was beginning to falter in Tennessee, and they needed someone of stature. So he ran, and then he ran for re-election 2 years later, and he got knocked off by a guy named Lean Jimmy Jones, who was a bit of a prankster and a kind of a cartoonish character. And Polk was, of course, very serious and drab of demeanor, and Lean Jimmy just ran rings around him. And Lean Jimmy won. So Polk basically said, I got to get that seat back or my political career is pretty much over. So he ran against Lean Jimmy 2 years later, and Lean Jimmy won again. So he was a two-term loser. Everyone thought his career was over. He calculated that the best way of getting back into the game was to cadge the vice presidential nod, probably with Martin Van Buren. But Martin Van Buren wasn't giving him much in the way of positive signals. But he's continued to, in his relentless way, position himself. And sure enough, when the convention deadlocked, they turned to Polk, and with a great deal of enthusiasm, I must say.
So you talk about how drab and dull Polk is, and yet in the 1844 race, he beat Henry Clay. I mean, that was before he changed his name to Henry Ali. But Henry Clay, I'm sorry, I know. But he was a political giant. So how does somebody drab and dreary beat a giant like Henry Clay?
By being brilliant, and he was brilliant, and he knew how to position himself on the issues. I'll just take one example, and that is the tariff race. He wanted to reduce tariff rates, but he had to get Pennsylvania. And Pennsylvania, of course, was an industrial nation, and they wanted protectionism. So he had to sort of craft a middle ground. And so he said, I'm in favor of reduced tariffs generally. I want tariffs to be where they need to be for the economical running of the government. But within that, I'm perfectly happy to accept protective tariffs for industries that may need it on a temporary or on a isolated basis. And that was just enough to sort of calibrate the vote of Pennsylvania, and he carried Pennsylvania, and that's one big reason why he managed to beat Henry Clay.
One of the few things I know about Polk is that in his 4 years as president, the geographical status of the United States grew enormously. He expanded U.S. territory with the acquisition of Oregon, and I mean, he did that. He could have gone to war with Britain over that, right? But there was no war.
He came very close. Just to show what he did do in terms of territorial aggrandizement, I'll see if I can sort of name the states. He brought in Washington, Oregon, Idaho, part of Montana, part of Wyoming, part of Colorado. Then he brought in Texas, California, New Mexico, Arizona, am I missing something, Nevada. So he basically increased America's territorial positioning by a third. And that's a huge number of square miles.
And also the U.S. now had a presence in two oceans, right?
Two oceans, poised to dominate the world, really. I mean, the America that we know today and that we've had in the 20th century would not have been possible had not Polk basically brought the country from sea to shining sea.
Now, I mentioned that, or you mentioned as well, that he got the Oregon Territory without going to war, but he did go to war with Mexico over California. How popular was that war?
Well, it was popular enough initially because he maneuvered America into that war in a way that brought a lot of patriotic fervor, as there always is patriotic fervor in the beginning of a war. But the war dragged on. It lasted more than 2 years, and a war that doesn't seem to have an end and just dragging on, and the president can't get out of it, as we know from Vietnam and we know a little bit from Iraq, can be pretty enervating to a political party and to a president. And that's what happened to James Polk.
Well, I was going to say that in the modern days, I mean, the wars you just mentioned, we heard allegations about lying to get us into the wars. Lyndon Johnson and the Bay of Pigs for Vietnam, George W. Bush and the weapons of mass destruction with Iraq. Was Polk honest about the reasons for going to war with Mexico?
He got a big rap for lying to the American people, and he has a lot of detractors among historians today, and he still gets that rap. I think it's a little bit of a bum rap. There's no question that he maneuvered America into that war and that he wasn't totally forthcoming with the American people in terms of what were the events that led to the confrontation, in which, by the way, I think 11 Americans were killed. I think maybe 11 or 12. I can't quite remember the number now. And so he went to the American people and he said, and to the Congress, and he said they have spilled American blood, shed American blood on the American soil. Well, it wasn't exactly American soil, although that's a debatable matter, perhaps. It was disputed soil. But he got his war, and then Mexico basically said, we're never going to give up. And Polk thought if he sort of sent an army a couple hundred miles into Mexico, they'd sue for peace. Well, they didn't sue for peace. We went all the way to Mexico City. We planted the American flag on their most hallowed municipal and governmental buildings. And finally, they did sue for peace, and we ended up paying for, but we ended up getting all that territory in the Southwest that I mentioned, including California.
Where was he on the issue of slavery?
Well, he was a slave owner, and he was a traditional Southern guy. So he was a defender of slavery. I think it would have to be said that he didn't have much of a moral imagination when it comes to the slavery issue. And of course, he lived in a different time from ours. But even within the context of that time, he lacked a sensitivity to the implications of slavery, which a lot of even Southern statesmen held.
Do you think he could have won a second term had he run?
Questionable. All because he expended a huge amount of political capital. He was a man of boldness, and the war and his other initiatives sapped a lot of his political standing. And, of course, the Whigs won the presidency after his four-year term, and so I would say that it's kind of a question on the cusp. He might have won a second term, but he had expended an awful lot of political standing in behalf of his big, bold agenda, and it generated a lot of controversy. But I will say that poor Polk in death gets buffeted quite a bit, just like he did in life. He was always struggling with the petty matters that he took umbrage at on the part of the people around him. He didn't have a very robust outlook on the world. He was crimped and suspicious. And maybe if you're saying, well, who would he be like? Well, I think maybe not in terms of his full character, but in terms of his temperament, maybe a little bit like Richard Nixon. He was very prickly.
Bob Murray is the author of A Country of Vast Designs, James K. Polk, The Mexican War and the Conquest of the American Continent. He also wrote Where They Stand, which I think is a lot of fun. It's a book that rates all the presidents, good and bad. Bob, thanks a lot for being on the program.
Oh, it was a pleasure, Ken. Thank you very much.
If I was to fight, would you fight against me? If I was to run, would you run with me? If I was to die, would you bury me?
That's it for this week's show. Be sure to check out our website for much more political content and to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. It's all at krpoliticaljunkie.com. If you've got comments, questions, or complaints, send an email to Ken at krpoliticaljunkie.com. You can also tweet us at Ken Rudin and at Ken Rudin Junkie, or follow the show on Facebook. And you can follow my button of the day on Instagram at The Political Junkie. Political Junkie is distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. The show is produced by Devin Maverick Robbins, and Douglas Bell is our coordinating producer and engineer. I'm Ken Rudin. Thanks for listening. See you next week.